Let's go ahead and get going, shall we?
We shall!
All right, cue music, please.
Oh, we're supposed to test the microphone first.
Hello?
Friends, welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and Comic Dungeon. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Chris Casso.
Hello.
Nicole Lamb.
Hello.
Cole Hornaday. And we are coming at you live from West of Lennon during the panel, the Panel Jumper Live, Chapter 5. And with us is our special guest, Eisner nominee and New York Times bestseller, Kazu Kibuishi. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us today. When we have guests, the first question that I like to start off is, how did you get into comics? Now, our audience, the studio audience here tonight, heard a lot, and so I wish I was actually rolling during all that because it's very interesting. But give us like the elevator, but not the elevator pitch, a long elevator. It's like you're going to the 100th floor of how you got into comics, please.
All right.
I know, it's a challenge.
Well, I'm like most comic artists. I started really young. You know, I was 5 years old. I just didn't have much else to do. I was mostly skateboarding and playing baseball or something. And when I was bored, I would draw and I would read Mad Magazine.
Yeah.
Cartoons Magazine was a huge one for me. And Garfield. You know, and that was what I had. And so, I just been drawing as a hobby. I kept telling my mom that she should rest assured, I'm not going to do this for a living.
I think everybody says that.
Because I told her I'll be a doctor. You know, like that's what she wanted me to be. So I said I'm just going to make this a hobby. So I remember thinking as a kid, well, I better draw a lot now. Because I'm not going to get to do this later. And I drew so much that I made it into a career.
Cool.
But by the time I was in high school, I had gotten skilled enough that I was offered work by a lot of by various publishers, including Extreme Studios at Image Comics as a background inker. They were looking for somebody they just liked the stuff that I was doing, and they were really, really great guys. Actually, asked if I wanted to do that. I actually decided at that time not to go into comics. I actually quit comics.
Mm-hmm.
Partly because I wasn't getting to read the kinds of comics I wanted to read. And I was more into reading literature like Steinbeck and Hemingway and in my English class. And so I thought cinema might be something closer to what I was wanting to do. So I went to film school. And then years later, I actually found Understanding Comics by Scott McCloud.
Yeah, Scott McCloud.
And I realized that, oh my goodness, comics are important. Like I've been treating them like garbage all my life. But I loved that. It was like garbage I loved, you know? You guys understand. I mean, there's something about it, like that it was so, you know, it's innocent in that way, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like I loved it because nobody else liked it. And so I was a ska punk rock kid, you know? I had long hair down to my shoulders and wore my grandpa's Hawaiian shirts. And that's the kind of kid I was. I was always the one getting my kids, my friends out of trouble. So comics was just a natural fit for me.
And what was your big break into like doing your own thing?
So I've always done my own thing.
Okay.
So I never wanted to draw comics for anybody. I wouldn't do it for a job. I worked in animation, mm-hmm. Not doing comics, and I worked as at an architecture firm. Doing graphic design. I worked at all sorts of places. I worked at a Target, which as a job I actually really liked.
My favorite job was working in a bowling alley.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. The day to day is pretty interesting,
yeah.
You know, and you actually learn a lot. As somebody at Target, I was talking with all sorts of people and I was learning all sorts of things. With comics, it was always very personal to me, And so I started up a webcomic called Copper on my site, and I said I'm only going to do one a month because I'm going to put like everything into that one page comic that I'm going to do, because I was also a big fan of comic strips like Winsor McCay's Little Nemo in Slumberland, Tintin, or Jay, right? And Bill Watterson's, you know...
Calvin and Hobbes,
and thinking like, well, remember Bill Watterson talking about how the newspaper, we were losing space to make art on the page. And he was correct. Oh, by the way, George Harriman, of course, Crazy Cat, the big inspiration, and Peanuts as well. And I thought, well, the web is infinite, right? An infinite canvas. So I thought, well, I'll just make at least something kind of big. And I did Copper on there, and I started posting that once a month. And then a lot of my heroes started emailing me. Scott McCloud emailed me and said, "Who are you?
Where did you come from?"
And then when we met, he was like, "Who are you? Like, you got to do this." And I said, "Okay." And I've had, you know, and that's just like been my whole career with arts and English, like English class. Like my English teacher did the same thing. She just said, you know, like I was like a B student, you know, and I wrote this essay where I was supposed to write like John Steinbeck, and I was a big Steinbeck fan, so I wrote like John Steinbeck, and she read it, and she said, "You gotta write for a living."
Sounds like you're really good at what you do, whatever you do.
Okay. Well, I think it hit them, you know, like it, personally, because in the next English class, I got like a C for not following directions, you know, and I do that a lot. I don't follow directions at all. So, you know, I just like to make my own directions.
Cool.
You know, with comics, there was just enough people saying, "You should do this, you should do this, you should do this." I was at the architecture firm. They were like, "What are you doing here? You should do that." And I'd be like, "Well, nobody buys this. Nobody wants this. Nobody wants this from me."
Yeah.
They keep telling me that.
We know, a lot of us know you from your Amulet series. And so people that we know who have children are familiar with you. I actually saw a Facebook post recently where a friend of mine posted, "OMG, Kazu Kibuishi's in this bookstore. What do I do?" and people were commenting like, "Oh, throw a towel over his head and kidnap him, or you know, just walk up to him. He's a dude." So do you do you get accosted in bookstores? Or are parents like, "Oh my God, you're the best. My kid loves your things."
That happens. You know, when I go to schools, it's like being the Beatles, you know. And but then they meet me and they're like, "Oh, you just like a dad." And that's kind of been my whole thing. Like, I remember starting my webcomic thinking, "Oh man, I'm gonna get a bunch of creepy emails." I was friends with Don Hertzfeldt, the creator of. He was part of Spike and Mike.
Rejected is my favorite. Rejected.
I mean, he was nominated for an Academy Award last year, you know, for World of Tomorrow. But I went to school with him, and so he was kind of my animation mentor. And I actually saw him having to deal with like a lot of fans who were, you know, who become obsessed with him. So I decided my thing is when people come to me, I am going to be a dad, and they're just going to be so bored of this. That it's just gonna make them go away. And so my first emails were, you know, when people would email me about, I would often just ignore everything. But when that kind of attention comes to me, I just tell them like, "Man, I'm just a dude, just like sports."
All right.
Like, so I got kids.
Yeah. So your stuff is I thought it was really considered young adult, but we've learned that it's officially middle grade, which was fascinating to me. Do we have questions about any of the young adult YA/middle grade process?
Well, one question I actually had for you was because we have so many customers, so many kids that shop at the store, their parents shop for them. They come in and they've been reading your book since the start. Mm-hmm. And so they've been aging as you've been releasing the series. Do you ever have much interaction with the kids and get to talk about what they get from that experience of growing up with it and rereading it over time?
It was interesting. I was just in Boston for the Massachusetts Independent Comics Expo. I was at the airport, and as I was... I got to talking with somebody in line, this couple, who were older than I was, and they had kids that were in college, and they were going to MIT and Harvard, you know, and when they texted that they were in line with me because they said, I think our kids read your stuff, and they texted and they were like, oh my God, you gotta take a selfie with him, you know, but these are kids who are in MIT, you know, and so. Doing the Harry Potter covers, that was actually one of the most interesting things, because those fans were young growing up, and they're older than my readers are. Mm-hmm. And so being able to step in the shoes of J.K. Rowling for a while, you know, because I'm often sent by Scholastic to represent Harry Potter, which is really surreal, you know? It's a really weird thing to do, you know, and I feel like I can't take any credit. So when I see that, though, I got a little, you know... I got a preview of what that would be like to speak with old people who are now older and have grown up with the books. Nice. But yeah, it is really neat.
Yeah. Cool. Nicole, do you have a question?
Yeah. Do you have like what makes an all-age comic successful? Like being able to read it when you're young and then reading it again. Like what elements that you put into it, or maybe what direction you have.
Yeah, this is a good question, and I've been thinking about it a lot lately because I'm a dad, you know.
Yeah.
And my kids are now starting. You know, my kids read my books now, and they're getting to the age that my readers are. Mm-hmm. When I started, I was writing for my 8-year-old self, so I wrote. It begins with this car accident scene that a lot of people seem to have, sometimes people have a problem with. I feel like, well, you know what? With Amulet, if you just go through the first 10 pages and you feel it's inappropriate or it's too difficult, then you can walk away from it immediately. Mm-hmm. But if you feel this is something that they might, you know, want to talk about, then it's like kind of like the ride height requirement for a roller coaster, right? I put it right at the beginning. It's a qualifier. I know that if it was me, if I read that, I go, whoa, like that like resonates with me, because when you're a kid, your world is your parents.
Yeah.
And so, you know, everyone's like saying, why do parents always die in Disney films? Well, the thing is with the kid, with kids literature and things like that, they don't have jobs. They're just the kids of their parents. And so when the parents are gone, that's like them losing their job, you know? It's like their fears realized.
Yeah.
And so they want to see what characters that they could look at like heroes, you know, they want to see what their heroes and villains would do in a situation where that they're afraid of. And so they're just kind of searching it out. And so I think when you're doing a good middle grade, like a book for younger readers, if there is a sense of empathy from the author, where the author said, you know what, I kind of went through what you're probably going through, so, you know, here's what I suggest through my characters. Like, maybe not even suggest, but just let's see what these characters do. And oftentimes, maybe they make a horrible mistake, you know, like a horror film, you know? You're just watching everybody just make mistakes, and you're like, don't do that. Don't do that. Don't do that. Just be really quiet.
Yeah.
You know? And so, you know, I think that the kids, they're processing it in that way.
Right.
So, for example, Raina Telgemeier's books are very different than mine, because it's often about the high stress of being in a social situation, you know? And that's not something I talk about in my books. I'm talking about kids who have to deal with their parents, like, debt. Right.
Yeah.
In my book too.
Right.
Like the kids are dealing with the phantoms of their parents' mistakes. but they're able to become strengthened by it rather than weakened by it, you know? They don't feel like they're weighed down by it. They actually look at it as a way to like, oh, this is a challenge. Let's figure this out, you know? And I'm just hoping that if I'm handing this book over to some young reader, then they're going to get a little more confidence to deal with their own situation. That's why I write that. And so if you can recognize that, if you read a book and scan through it and you go, oh, yeah, this is like something that somebody could use, I think that book is likely going to be a hit. You know, so I actually kind of get bummed out when my books are successful. Because I know that it means a lot of people need something like that, you know?
Right, right.
I'd rather just it be helpful for a very small number of people.
Yeah.
Like at all the time. I mean, I don't need that much to live, you know. just enough is fine with me. Like honestly. And so I it bums me out sometimes when I do see it become very successful. It wasn't the point. But now that I'm here doing that, I just want to make sure I do my job well.
Yeah.
So kind of like you're a dad in the comics too.
Yeah.
Giving
but,
life lessons,
you know, but
almost.
There's no real replacement for real being a real dad or being a real parent. And I don't want to like say that you could just put this book there and it would replace that, you know,
because
there is none. So my hope is that the parents really enjoy the books too.
Yes.
So then they can read it with the kids and they just have something to talk about. So the water cooler talk isn't just within the framework of their friends or their peers, but also with their kids or their parents or their grandparents, you know, and that was my hope. Because I just didn't see that much stuff around, like in entertainment, where it was, there were multiple generations enjoying it. It's very rare.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, Kazu, we could talk to you forever, but...
sorry, I'm taking over the mic here. Yeah.
No, that's all right. thank you so much for joining us. What's your website where people can go and find your things?
Oh, yeah. Boldcity.com, named after the film that got stolen. Right.
And that is a story, let me tell you,
yeah,
friends.
Sorry, you guys missed that.
All right. Well, at the end of every show, we play quiz time, and usually it's questions amongst the panel here, but I'm going to give these questions to you. So we have packets of comics donated by Comics Dungeon. Chris Cusseau, do you want to tell us? Yeah.
Yeah. It is full of Comics Dungeon exclusive covers, including Star Wars Adventures number 1, which has a great cover by Mike Mayhek of Rey from The Force Awakens. And then there's some Valiant comics in there. There's some DC comics in there. Just a little bit of everything.
There's some cat cosplay covers in there.
Cat. That's
literally a cat in a costume.
A cat
in armor.
Yes.
This is your pack.
It. All right, so we're going to do that now. Cue the quiz time music, please, and can we have the house lights up? All right, so we've spoken a lot about young adult graphic novels. I'm going to ask you 3 questions about that one author who was a literary bridge for many of us with his books aimed at youngsters, but which explored many adult themes, Shel Silverstein. Mr. Silverstein is an accomplished poet and songwriter, having written many songs for the 1970s group Dr. Hook and the Medicine Show, among others. What poem of his was recorded by Johnny Cash in 1969, which made it all the way to number 2? Raise your hands, don't shout it out. On Billboard's Top 100 of the Year, Cole, pick one. A Boy Named Sue is correct. Go give him a prize. All right. Number 2. Shel Silverstein's 1964 picture book, The Giving Tree, can still be found in most homes across the country, even though after 50 plus years, it ranks high on both favorite and least favorite lists of children's books. We are not going to delve into the selfishness, narcissism, codependency, or anti-environmental themes therein, because this is ultimately a happy show. The question is, the boy said many things to the giving tree, but what did the boy never say? Raise your hand if you think you know the answer. Yes, you right there in the red. He never said thank you. That is correct. Okay, and finally, number 3. As the saying goes, never meet your heroes. Well, never research your heroes either. Trying to come up with questions regarding Mr. Silverstein and his obvious disdain for children is bumming me out. So this last question is about Batman the Animated Series. Before Mark Hamill took over the role of the Joker, this actor was originally cast but subsequently replaced because the producers felt his interpretation of the character was too scary. Raise your hand. Oh, right there. Yes, it was Tim Curry. Give that man a prize. Well, that is quiz time. I want to extend a very special thank you to Kazu Kibuishi. Thank you all for listening, and we will see you at PerfectBoundPodcast.com.